Tonight, I'm pleased to welcome Perry Hampton, who will discuss restoring coral reefs in Guam. He and other aquarium staff members recently traveled there with SeaCore, an organization that studies sexual coral reproduction and promotes reef conservation. Perry tells me that they had wonderful accommodations over there, and they actually prepared their own food, and they just had to leave grocery lists, and they were provided, and he and his roommates populated the list primarily with Captain Crunch and toilet paper. But thankfully, they were able to trade some of that toilet paper with the other rooms who went the more gourmet route to get invited for dinner, so it all worked out. Perry's been with the Aquarium of the Pacific since 1997. Upon his arrival in Long Beach about 16 months before the aquarium opened, he was involved in acquiring specimens for the exhibits, establishing quarantine facilities and procedures, and holding tanks. Before coming to the Aquarium of the Pacific, he spent 15 years at the National Aquarium in Baltimore. As Vice President of Husbandry, Perry is responsible for overseeing all of our programs involving our animal collection and its welfare. He is a regular spokesperson for the Aquarium of the Pacific in media interviews and serves as our liaison with the Association of Zoos and Aquariums. It is my pleasure to introduce Perry Hampton.
Okay, thanks a lot, Nate. You should never underestimate the value of toilet paper as a method of currency. When people don't have it, they really need it. Anyway, so I'm going to talk to you tonight about an exciting new conservation project that the Aquarium of the Pacific has gotten involved in. This is actually our second year of involvement. See if I can remember how I was instructed to operate this. Okay. This was a workshop that three of us participated in Guam back in July, from the 14th through the 21st, I think it was. We're working with an organization called SeaCore, and SeaCore is an acronym that stands for Sexual Coral Reproduction. This is a nonprofit organization that was founded in 2002 by a gentleman named Dr. Dirk Peterson. He was a coral specialist at the Rotterdam Zoo in Holland. He's actually a German national, but he was working there. We hear you, Janet. Not to try to embarrass you or anything. Now, anyway, what the SeaCore's what they're all about. The reason he founded this organization, again, he was an aquarist there, and he wanted to try to develop ways to provide a more sustainable source for corals for aquariums, particularly in Europe. A lot of corals are protected under various international laws, things like that. Trade is restricted depending upon species, things like that. And in Europe, the rules are even tighter, I think, than they are here. So I have a feeling that probably had a lot to do with his motivation for getting this started. A short time later, he decided to expand this work into field conservation involving restoration of degraded reefs and things like that. And that's some of what we're going to talk about tonight. We're going to talk a little bit about why some of the corals need help, what some of the threats are that they're facing worldwide, not just in Guam, and just a really brief primer on diseases, real quick. And you know, the project was really all about restoration. So we're going to talk a little bit about what's involved in that. It's I think you'll find it's quite involved, quite a lot goes into it. But it's also important to have an understanding before we really talk about the process, how we actually do the restoration work. You have to have an understanding of how corals reproduce too. So we'll spend a little bit of time on that as well. If we have time here, if I can get through this quickly enough, also talk a little bit about where we hope to go with the future with some of these things. So. Okay. Okay, I actually kind of covered some of this stuff already. When SeaCore first got started, their initial work was down the Caribbean, primarily in Curacao. They established a sort of a base of operations in Curacao almost immediately, and they have remained there ever since. Every year they go back to Curacao and continue to work on some of the species of corals that have been threatened down there. They've also done some work in Puerto Rico and Mexico a little bit more recently, but Curacao is where the majority of the work has taken place. we would go to professional conferences, and Dr. Peterson would come and give updates on the project. Folks from other zoos and aquariums have been involved in this from the beginning. And, you know, we sort of looked longingly at this and thought, boy, that'd be a really nice project to get involved in. But because we're the Aquarium of the Pacific and they were doing all their work down the Caribbean, I kind of felt it was be a little bit hard for us to justify the expense of getting involved at that point. When they announced that they were going to expand their operations to the Pacific last year, we immediately jumped on it and took advantage of the opportunity. And we sent Sandy Troutwine, who's here somewhere, I don't know where she's escaped to, and Sandy and Danny. Sandy went last year. This was our first representative on the SeaCorps project. And this year was the seasoned veteran who took Danny and I under her wing and made sure that we didn't make any mistakes. But Danny is assistant curator of fishes and invertebrates for the Tropical Pacific Gallery. And you'll see both of their photos in here periodically as we proceed through. Some of the other folks that were involved, as I said, there's a lot of other zoos and aquariums involved in this. It's truly an international operation. There's people from not only from the U.S., but also Canada. There's a gentleman from Omaha's Henry Dorley Zoo who's been very involved in this. He's a longtime coral aficionado, and he's been involved with SeaCorps long before it came to Guam. I think he was one of the folks that initially got involved back when it was just getting started. But folks from a number of other places, and I think I even left a few off the list here, too. So a lot of enthusiasm for these projects. So a lot of this was kind of a learning experience for those of us who are participants in the project. We got the opportunity to learn a little bit about what's involved in coral reproduction and captive spawning techniques and restoration work. We participated in all of those things. You can't undervalue the importance of just the networking that took place, because we came away from this with a lot of ideas for future projects, even away from the actual reefs out in Guam. So if we get the opportunity, we'll talk a little bit about one of those later on. And education and outreach is perhaps one of the most important elements of the whole operation. Reef restoration is all about fixing a problem that has occurred. If you can prevent the problem from happening in the first place, you save yourself a lot of time, energy, and effort. And the best way to do that is by educating the population, both locally, places like Guam or Curacao or whatever, but also all of those facilities that you saw there, all of us aquariums and zoos, reach literally millions of people. So we kind of help spread the gospel of coral reef protection and conservation, if you will. So why was Guam chosen when they decided to expand? And then, of course, where is it? A lot of people may ask that question. I'm glad you asked. Right out here, when you fly from Los Angeles, you get to Hawaii, you can see you're not even halfway. I think it's 5 hours to Hawaii and another 7 hours to Guam. Some people, depending upon where you're coming from, it's actually easier to go to Japan and then down there straight. No coincidence, they get a lot of Japanese tourists, because it's sort of like, you know, the Bahamas or Hawaii might be for us. It's relatively close. It's about maybe 2,000 miles east of the Philippines. Other information about Guam, it's American territory. A lot of people may not know that. Oddly enough, you do have to have a passport and you have to go through customs when you come in and out. I don't really quite understand that one, but you do. It's 17 hours ahead, so which actually makes it about 5 minutes after noon on Thursday there right now. They're just having their lunch. Makes it a little bit difficult when you want to coordinate phone calls and so forth. The island itself is about 30 miles by 8 miles, which makes it just slightly larger than Catalina, for some perspective. But it's got a whole lot more people living on it. There's about 160,000 people there, and they get about 1.3 million tourists a year on average. The Spaniards discovered the island in the 1500s when they were going around snapping up real estate everywhere. I guess that came as a little bit of a surprise to the Polynesians that had been living there for a few hundred years at that point. It was invaded by Japan 2 days after Pearl Harbor in 1941, and about a year and a half later, 2 years, I guess, U.S. forces recaptured the island. Interestingly enough, July 21st is Liberation Day there, and it's a big holiday for the locals. We were actually there for that, and they have a big parade and big celebration. So that was kind of interesting to see. Ironically enough, though, it's a very popular tourist destination for Japanese and also Russians. We did see a lot of Russians while we were there. Apparently, the State Department removed the requirement for Russians to have a visa to go there, so it's very easy for them. I imagine they probably did that at the request of the merchants and so forth. So. And then if anybody's familiar with the aquarium, you're probably very familiar with the story of the brown tree snake, which is kind of the poster child for all the bad things that can happen if you introduce a species into an environment where it's never been and, you know, not supposed to. But that's another story for another night. So. As far as why we want to get involved with coral restoration work there, Guam has a fairly extensive reef system covering a significant amount of the shallow near coastal waters. There's a great deal of biodiversity there. It's not too far from the famous coral triangle area. Just like everywhere else, the reefs, places that have coral reefs value them for all of the reasons you can see here. Coastal protection mitigates the effects of things like tsunamis and typhoons and so forth, helps prevent erosion. Tourism, of course, is huge, as we already saw. Things like fisheries, a lot of reefs serve as habitat and nursery for all kinds of different types of fishes. So a lot of people make their livelihood off of it. Recreation, of course, is tied with tourism. And then, of course, research and education are very important as well. So these are all reasons why Guam's reefs are very important to the folks on the island there. However, they've been having a lot of problems with their reefs. It was estimated in the 1960s that coral covered approximately 50% of the nearshore waters, the surface area. And by the 1990s, it had been cut in half. And by 2011, it was down to 10%. A lot of this was due to crown of thorns starfish predation that has taken place over the last 30, 40 years. However, there were also a lot of bleaching events that contributed to this. Now, we'll talk more about bleaching in a few minutes. But it's happened a number of times. The most severe event was in 2013, just after we were down there. In fact, Sandy and some of the other folks who were on the trip the year before, when they were with us this year, all remarked that they were surprised and shocked at the amount of bleached corals that they saw that had not been there the previous year. So it had degraded significantly just in 1 year. And in fact, just since we've been there, they've been experiencing a pretty severe bleaching event as well. There's also, like a lot of these places, there's a lot of fishing pressure too. And the problem there, they've fished out a lot of the, sort of fishing down the food chain is the expression. You start with a lot of the top predators, most of those are gone. Then people start to go after things that, you know, we think of as maybe ornamental fishes that we would have on display here. You know, and these folks are having them for dinner. The problem is a lot of these are herbivores, and they're responsible for controlling algae. So without them, you get a lot of algal growth, which overwhelms the corals as well. So a lot of these things contribute to coral degradation, even stuff that you might not immediately think of as a problem. Erosion and sedimentation are an issue. They have a kind of a unique situation there. There are feral pigs and deer that live on the island. And what some of the folks like to do, they like to hunt them. And they found the easiest way to hunt them is by burning down some of the jungle. And the deer and the pigs are attracted to the delicious little shoots that start of vegetation that start to grow back up in the burned areas. So they come out to eat those, and they're exposed and they're easy to shoot. The problem there is that when you burn down the vegetation, you're exposing all of the soil to erosion whenever you get rain. And in a place like this, they get a lot of rain. It happens all the time. It's tropical. So that's become a big problem. A lot of the soil washes out into the ocean and covers over the corals. It's not all bad news. There is some good news. They created a number of, recognized some of the problems and created a number of marine protected areas. And they've definitely seen a big improvement in biodiversity and species density and all of these kind of things. Marine protected areas do work, and they work very well. The areas that have been impacted by crown of thorns starfishes are generally limited to a little bit deeper water. What are some of the threats to corals? I have another slide that's going to come up in a second about talk a little bit more about bleaching. So we'll just mention that bleaching is important. We'll get into that in a second. Diseases are something else that affect corals. And again, these aren't just in taking place in Guam. This is kind of indicative of threats that corals are facing worldwide. Guam is just sort of a microcosm of this. Predation, and when we talk about predation primarily, we're talking about this guy right here. This is the crown of thorns starfish, and a lot of you probably heard about infestations of those that have taken place in many places. The Great Barrier Reef is one example, but it's happening throughout the Pacific. Pollution, and especially nutrients. When we talk about nutrients, we're talking about nitrates and phosphates, and these are the result of either untreated or inadequately treated sewage. And the problem with those, if you go to the hardware store and you buy fertilizer, what's in it? Phosphates and nitrates, because they make plants grow. Well, in the ocean, we're talking about algae. And algae, generally speaking, is bad around coral reefs because it overwhelms the coral and covers them over. So those are some of the biggest problems with pollutants. Tourist activities, basically, like so many places, you get too many people in too small of an area, we're loving the reefs to death. And the problem is people get out there and they're not adequately, educated about it, and folks stand on the coral and, disrupt it and cause a lot. Plus, there's just simply the impact of having that many people concentrated in such a small area is bound to have a negative impact no matter what. Ship strikes, really not that big of a problem. That's the kind of thing that has a major impact in a very small area, but unless there's a release of hazardous materials, it's usually, pretty limited in scope. Acidification is something that we don't really know. It's probably going to be something that's going to affect corals negatively in the future, but we don't know for sure what the impact is going to be. For those of you who are not aware of what that means, as we produce carbon dioxide through our industrial processes, it goes out into the atmosphere, and we produce so much that a lot of it gets absorbed into the oceans. And what happens then, as any first-year chemistry student can tell you, as the CO2 gets absorbed into the water, it forms carbonic acid, which lowers the pH. And the pH interferes with the coral's ability to absorb calcium out of the water. And it's not just corals, by the way. It's any animal that utilizes calcium carbonate, like mollusks and crustaceans, things like crabs and so forth, that need calcium carbonate to make a shell or a skeleton of some sort. And the lower pH, it's not happening dramatically, but remember, the pH scale is logarithmic, so a little bit goes a long way. And it does have an impact on animals like that ability to absorb calcium and survive. So back to bleaching. I imagine a lot of you probably know what bleaching is, but just real quick for those who don't. Bleaching is a process that occurs when corals get stressed. And most often, this is when the water is too warm for their liking. They possess a microscopic algae within their tissues. It's coral is an animal, but it has algae tissue, algae cells living within its tissues. The coral is actually, the structure is almost like rock with a very thin living tissue on the outside, maybe a millimeter thick, if that, of living tissue. All the rest is solid calcium carbonate rock that's been built up over perhaps hundreds of years, depending upon the size of the coral head. But that thin living tissue is composed of individual little polyps, separate little coral animals, and each one has this algae living within its tissues. If the coral gets stressed, it will eject the the algae from its system. And this is a commensal relationship. The coral benefits from having the algae in its tissues. If the event that causes the stress is relatively short-lived, the coral can reabsorb new zooxanthellae algae and can survive. But if it's an extended stress event, usually the coral will not survive. So in the case of bleaching, what you're seeing, at least at the beginning anyway, this is an example of some bleached coral. This is a good example right over here, where what you're seeing is the coral tissue is still there, but it's transparent, and you're actually seeing through the coral tissue, and you're seeing the white calcium carbonate skeleton underneath. The rest of the brown part over here is unaffected healthy tissue. If this continues, eventually the whole coral head will probably become affected and die. This is another head here with a little bit, it's not quite as obvious, but it's actually more extensive on this coral head. Corals can recover as long as the bleaching event doesn't last for too long. And it's important to remember that this tissue, at this stage at least, is still alive. So another thing that affects corals, which the causative agents for diseases are a lot of the same things that cause diseases in human beings and in other types of animals and plants and so forth. And these are things like bacteria, protozoans, viruses, all of the same things that affect us also affect corals in various different ways. Some of them cause the coral to turn white, and they look very much, like in the example up here, it looks very much like the bleached coral. The difference is, this is all dead tissue. There is no tissue left there anymore. All of this is gone, and all you're seeing is the actual calcium carbonate skeleton, as opposed to the other slide we saw a minute ago with the bleached coral, where the tissue is still there, but it's just become transparent. There's a variety of different types of diseases. Yes, they're caused by bacteria and viruses and things like that, but in most cases, they're probably exacerbated by a lot of these other stressors that we talked about. Maybe pollution, maybe water's too warm, whatever it might be. It's sort of like the straw that broke the camel's back kind of thing. Most of us can deal with a certain amount of stress or disease-causing elements, things like that. But if it gets to be too much, it overwhelms our immune system. Same thing is true with things like corals. So, what can we do? It's important I wanted to talk about the definitions here. You'll hear me saying coral reef restoration, rehabilitation. The folks that are involved in this routinely like to assign definitions to these things. And one of them is that as far as restoration is concerned, the definition for that means it's bringing a degraded ecosystem back to its original condition. The problem with that is it's hard to define what the original condition is like. The definition of rehabilitation is the act of replacing the structural or functional characteristics of an ecosystem. That's maybe doesn't go quite as far, but it might be a little bit more achievable. I thought it was important to talk about that. But for the most part, I'll probably be using the word restoration just simply because it's easy to lapse into that. But I wanted you to understand that. Coral reef restoration, one thing that I certainly learned from this is that this is a very, very expensive and very time-consuming and labor-intensive process with a very long return on investment. So you really have to think very hard and long about how your resources are being used. A comprehensive risk assessment, sort of a cost-benefit analysis, is definitely in order before you embark on a project like this. You have to ask questions like, well, what caused the reef to be degraded in the first place? Do those conditions still exist? If not, are they likely to return? Are there sufficient protections in place, things like marine protected areas, fishing regulations, pollution controls, and are they enforced? Because if you don't have these kind of things, coral reef restoration by itself, you might as well not even do it because you'll be wasting your time. It's one tool in the toolbox, but it's not going to be successful unless you do some of these other things at the same time. It's also not currently possible. Coral reef restoration is great for small scale fixes in limited areas, but it's not something that's going to help with widespread coral reef losses caused by things like crown of thorns starfish infestations and massive bleaching events and things like that. One thing I found in one of the publications we had on the subject, that this quote I thought was great, is that coral reef restoration and rehabilitation should never be considered as an alternative to proper coastal management. Just like with everything else, you're really better off if you can prevent the problem in the first place than to try to fix it later on. So, I didn't mean to throw cold water all over everything and sort of paint kind of a negative picture. It is important, and it's definitely worthwhile. Why bother? Because coral reefs are really important, and for a whole lot of reasons. A lot of people's lives depend upon them for food and livelihood. Biodiversity. Some of the coral reefs are some of the most biodiverse areas on the planet. These are all reasons why it's definitely worth doing. As I mentioned, though, it's really just one tool, but it can't do the job by itself. You really have to have these other elements in place too for it to be successful. So now a little bit about coral biology. So corals reproduce basically two ways. There's sexual reproduction and there's asexual reproduction. And when you're talking about sexual reproduction, there's two ways that they do that. So we're going to talk about each of these. And most corals, most hard corals, reef-building corals that we're familiar with, that we're talking for the purposes of this discussion, are what's known as broadcast spawners. That means that each of those little individual polyps on a coral head are hermaphrodites. That means they're technically, they're both sexes within one, and they release eggs and sperm. And what happens is this will, and you'll see this examples of this in a little bit, these float up to the surface, and the fertile coral sperm from this coral head will mix with eggs from that coral head, and that's how you get fertilization to take place. It's a very predictable cycle. It's tied to the lunar cycle, and it happens at most 1 to 2 times every year. It's been very well documented, as you'll see in a minute. You can almost set your watch by it, literally. This is just a diagram I found of that kind of explains the process a little bit. You've got a coral head that releases eggs and sperm. They're buoyant. They float up to the surface in little bundles, actually. You'll see pictures of these. They look sort of like BBs, but a little bit smaller. They float to the surface. The bundles break apart and release the eggs and sperm, which mix with that from other coral heads due to wave action and currents and wind action and all that sort of thing. Then you get fertilized eggs, which develop into little multicellular embryos, eventually turn into a free-swimming form known as planula. And at this point, they're plankton. They're floating around out there with everything, all the fish larvae and phytoplankton and other types of zooplankton. And then usually 3 or 4 days after the fertilization has taken place, they will hopefully, if all the conditions are right, and by the way, they almost never are, then they will settle out and then grow up into eventually become an adult colony. Remember, we are talking about millions or maybe tens of millions of larvae that are produced, probably for every single coral that actually settles out successfully somewhere to develop into a new coral colony. While they're part of the plankton, most of them become food for other types of plankton, for fish larvae, for whatever it might be. Some of them will just get carried away by adverse currents into maybe deep water or someplace where there aren't suitable places to settle out. So very few of them actually survive to become coral colonies. And part of what we're doing is we're hoping to sort of stack the deck a little bit and improve the odds. The other type of sexual reproduction that takes place is kind of similar. Sperm is released from the coral colony. They'll settle on another one nearby. but the fertilization takes place internally instead of out in the water column. And those planula that you saw on the other slide there are actually released, say fully developed, from the coral head. They float around for a short time and settle down relatively nearby. This method is only employed by about 25% of hard corals. It doesn't have nearly the same degree of genetic diversity that the other one has. One question I kind of had in my mind that I haven't really been able to answer to my own satisfaction is why evolution has, there's got to be a reason for this, what the benefit is, and I'm not entirely sure why this one would be employed by even as many coral species as there are, but that's a good question, I think. And then asexual reproduction is what takes place when an established coral colony just simply expands in size. The individual polyps will divide, just like you can see in the illustration over here. This was a single polyp, and it's just dividing, much like cells can divide. And that's how the coral colony expands. Each separate polyp is identical. It's basically a clone of its neighbor. What we're talking about tonight is the first, the broadcast spawners. And this is a chart that I got out of that coral reef restoration manual that shows where corals, or what time of year corals reproduce in various parts of the world. And you can see that in Guam, this takes place every year in June and July, right here. Now, as I mentioned, it's very predictable. This event usually takes place between 6 and 8 days after the full moon in July. It could also be in August. I said it's 1 to 2 times a year, but generally speaking, it would be in July. This year, the full moon was on the 12th. We were down there from the 14th to the 21st, and we expected the, we came back after that. The expected dates of spawning were the 18th to the 21st, and I think we saw the peak occurred on the 20th, as I recall. So again, it's very predictable, and this is about 8 o'clock, and that's what to me is really kind of astounding. Sunset was at 6:52 on those days, and you find that if you get in the water and you're watching the corals, hoping to see them spawn, and if it's 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock comes around, nothing happens. You get out of the water because it's not going to happen that night. So, again, very predictable. So, the benefits of doing this in-house. Remember, I said we're trying to stack the deck here in our favor. We're trying to sort of jumpstart the process. And the benefits of doing this is it allows us to get a very high yield, sort of a head start with a lot of corals that we can then transplant in suitable habitat later on. Basically, this is the process in a nutshell. I'm going to go through each of these in a little bit more detail. You'll see photos of these that illustrate the process. The first thing we do is go out on the reef and we get corals and we bring them in. We call these parent colonies. These are ones that we're going to be using in the lab that we hope will spawn. We'll be able to collect eggs and sperm from them. If they're produced, we're going to mix those together so that we get good fertilization. We will then place the fertilized eggs in suitable containers. We call these chrysals. Any of you have been here before, you know anything about some of the systems that we use to display jellies, for example. We use a special kind of tank that has a circular, very gentle circular water flow for planktonic organisms like jellies, for example. It also works very well for the coral larvae, and you'll see all examples of these in a minute. After a bit, we'll move the coral, the fertilized eggs, who have now reached a stage we know as planula. We'll move those into settlement tanks, and they'll be allowed to settle out on appropriate surfaces. These will be little tiles that are made out of porcelain or concrete, something like that. That's very porous, provides good surface area for them to grow on. And then eventually they're moved to offshore nurseries where they're allowed to grow in the environment that's very similar to what they'll be experiencing on the reef later on. And then ultimately we're going to transplant those coral colonies onto an area of degraded reef where it needs a little help. We had to work very closely with the staff there at the University of Guam's lab. It's important to build relationships. So the first thing they had to do was, and this happened by, this work was performed by some of the Sea Corps folks before most of us got down there. They received a permit from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service that allowed them to go out and collect several colonies of coral that would be brought back into the lab to be used as parent colonies. So they would scour the reef, and the species that we used is a type of branching coral that's very common down there in that area. It's known as Acropora circulosa, and this is an example of one he's got in his hand here. He's just picked up. He's going to collect and take back. There's a few more growing around here. And then these are some of the Acropora colonies that have been brought back. You can see here, relatively small. By the way, in Curacao, they do things a little bit differently. The coral species that they're working with down there are much larger. Acropora palmata, the elkhorn coral. Some of these coral colonies can be as large as cars. And obviously that's not something you can easily transplant back into the lab, nor would you want to. So in that case, what they do is they set up these net-like structures over the top of the coral and that catches the eggs and sperm off the coral head out on the reef rather than bringing the coral heads into the lab in that particular case. But we have a little bit more control over the process in the lab. In these kind of situations, budget is always very important. We use a lot of really high-tech equipment like these salad bowls you see here. These are the chrysals that we set up, and you'll see those again in a little bit. Here they are down here, set up in a little shallow tray with water circulating around. These have little sections cut out with a micron-grade screen that's glued on there. And this will allow water to circulate through there, but it's fine enough that the coral larvae can't get through. And a lot of time spent on that. So on the evenings when we anticipate the coral to spawn, again, it can happen over a 3 or 4 day period, most likely, we'll have folks, we divide it up in the group in half, and half the folks would be out on the reef diving, observing the coral, documenting any spawning that would take place out there with the live corals out, or the wild corals on the reef. And then simultaneously, the other half of the group was back in the lab, and we've taken those corals out of those trays that you saw them in before, and we put them in each one in these individual little Rubbermaid containers here. Again, real high-tech equipment with little lids on them. It's gotten dark out. We cover them over, the idea so that we're not messing up the photo period that they've become accustomed to. We don't want to do anything that might inhibit them from spawning as they would normally, so we try to keep it dark and keep them covered, periodically open them up real quickly just and see if there's any activity taking place. If nothing happens, they go back into the tanks and we try again the next night, and sometimes that does happen. Okay, Evan, you cue my little video. So this is a video of the corals actually releasing the egg and sperm bundles into the water. You can see that's what these are. It's releasing them, and these are buoyant. As I say, they have lipids, fats that cause them to float. And when these little, each of them is probably about maybe a little bit more than a millimeter in diameter. When they reach the surface, they'll float around for a bit, and then they'll break open, and that's when the eggs and the sperm are released on the water's surface. This is a real close-up, and you can see one right there just being released from the polyp. Bloop, there it goes. So. This lasts about a minute or so. So they get to the surface. This is actually filmed in a little aquarium. The gentleman that filmed this is from the Pittsburgh Zoo. He's an excellent photographer and videographer. And in fact, most of the photos that you're seeing here are hits. He's really good. pretty much it. Thanks, Evan. So I hedge my bets here a little bit because I never trust these videos to work properly. So I threw a still photo in here of the same thing because I wasn't sure if it would work or not. So this is the same still shot from the same video. Again, you can see each polyp will release these little bundles. And they both can, remember, they're hermaphrodites. Each polyp is a separate animal that lives in a colony with all of its neighbors. They're all genetically identical to each other. And each one is hermaphrodite, so each one of these little bundles contains both eggs and sperm. When they get to the surface, they float around, they look like this, and usually within a few minutes, because of wave action and so forth, the coating or the covering on the outside of the bundle will dissolve and they'll break open. So what we will do then is once they've released these eggs and sperm bundles on the surface, we'll, again, using real high-tech Dixie cup, we'll just kind of skim them off the surface and collect them and move them over into a bucket. I think they come from Home Depot. And allow them to mix. And it's literally sticking your hand in there and mixing it up real good. Usually let them go for 30 to 40 minutes or so, something like that. And then eventually what we'll do is transfer those into those. This, now you can see the chrysal here a little bit better. This is how they're set up. We make these little PVC frames. This tank is a tray that's about a foot deep maybe. There's water circulating around on the outside, and water comes in by means of these little jets here. There's four of them. And by means of controlling those with little valves, we can create nice gentle little flow in there. And the idea is so that they move around, but they're not, you know, settling down on the bottom or getting stuck to the sides or anything like that. And that's kind of what they look like on the surface. Some of them haven't fully broken open yet, looks like. And then what we'll do is we'll take some of them and look at them under the microscope. The cell development process is pretty well defined, and you know that if all's going well, after a certain period of time, you should see the cells divide, going from one mass basically to two separate cells to four to 16 and so forth. And this is all pretty predictable. So you want to look at that and make sure that things are moving along as you would expect them to. And then this is kind of what it would look like. Fortunately, we've got it on the camera here, so you can see this is a fairly well-developed embryo that's divided into, I don't know, there may be as many as 16 cells there now. It's hard to tell, but it's developing nicely. And each of us would do an overnight shift. On the nights when the corals would spawn, a couple of us would stay there all night just to kind of babysit them. And that means just periodically going out to the chrysals and making sure you're using a pipette and just gently washing the edges of it to make sure they're not sticking to the sides and that the flow is good and that sort of thing. Bringing some in and looking at them under the microscope, taking some photos for documentation, that kind of thing. It's a lot of effort to go through, and we wouldn't want to have any problems simply because nobody was there watching it over during the night. The other thing we'll do is take a sample and do a little statistical analysis to try to get an estimate of what we expect our yield is. And it looks like here on this particular night, we had over 250,000 larvae that were produced. So we were pretty happy with that. That was just one night. Unfortunately, I don't have a photo of the settlement tanks, but they're not terribly exciting anyway. We're talking about a concrete tank that's about 8 or 10 feet long, 2.5, 3 feet wide, and about 2.5, 3 feet deep. So once the corals have been in the chrysals there for about 3 or 4 days, when they reach the point where they're turning into planula, and those planula are reaching the point where they're starting to show signs of settling out, like they would do out in nature, then it's time to move them out of the chrysals and into the settlement tank with conditioned tiles. And I say conditioned. These, and you'll see some pictures of these later. They're little pieces of either concrete or porcelain that are designed to provide a good surface area for the corals to grow on. But first, before we use them, we allow them, we leave them in the water, in the systems, in the lab, or else out in the ocean to grow some coralline algae on them first, because it is the coralline algae that releases chemicals into the water that give the corals the cue that, hey, this is a good place to settle out. So we want the corals to settle on these tiles, so it's important to have them properly conditioned first. And then after a while, the tiles are then moved from the settlement tank into an offshore nursery. And this is actually what, this is what some of the tiles look like. These are little sort of tetrahedron shapes. Some of the ones we used this year were a little bit more triangular. They didn't have the sort of three-dimensional look, but same idea. Not terribly large. You want to situate your nursery someplace where it's going to be protected. You want it deep enough that it's not going to be affected too much by surface waves. You want it in a place where people aren't going to mess with it. The location where we chose it is in a marine protected area, which is incidentally pretty close to where we were taking the corals out and planting them on the reef too. So that worked out pretty conveniently. So this is the location where we planted the corals this year. I don't know if Sandy, if you went to the same spot last year, or you had a different one last year. This is in a marine protected area. This pier that you see here, this is like an underwater viewing thing. You walk out here on this pier and you go down a spiral staircase, and then there's windows that look out into the ocean, and people go out there and feed fish. That's the one spot where we saw a lot of fish, the only spot where we saw a lot of fish, really. It's notably devoid of fish in most areas, except for there. They're all over there because they get fed. The one thing I remember most about this was it's a really long swim to get out to where we were going to put the corals. We were joking that we were planting the corals in the Philippines. We got in the water, most of us got in the water about 100 yards or so to the left outside the picture here. And when we were even with this thing, we weren't even halfway. So it was quite a long way out there. Anyway, this is what one of the tiles looks like, right here. And it's got this one. This is one of the ones, I don't know, Sandy, I don't know if you wrote your name on there last year or not. This is probably one of the ones that, was a result of the propagation work that the folks did last year. And now they're ready to be placed on the reef. First, a little preparation work is in order. Like to scrub the rocks there a little bit. Our volunteer divers here, I'm sure, could relate to this. You have to prepare the surface a little bit. Notice that the water's not very deep here. This is only about 4 or 5 feet deep. This area was chosen. Although it's in a marine protected area, there has been some reef degradation that's taken place there, so it's protected, but it's also a pretty good candidate because it needs a little bit of help. So he's preparing the surface there. And the next thing we're going to do is we're going to literally glue the coral tiles down to the reef. We use a two-part epoxy. It's the same stuff we use here in the aquarium. We call it splash compound. It's this evil-looking, shiny black putty on one hand, and then we have another can that has bright yellow, and you take the equal parts of the two and you mix them together for a few minutes until you get this brown, sort of mustardy-colored looking material, and then you know it's evenly mixed, and it sets up underwater, and it works great for this kind of application. So you then very carefully take it and place it all around your little coral tile, being careful not to cover the coral, which I almost did on mine. And then you got it situated there. This is actually Sandy's kind of doing the little final touch-up work on hers. And then because we want to keep track of these corals, we want to come back and monitor their growth and development. It would be hard to find them. They're not real big. So we mark them with these little plastic tags. These are actually tags that farmers use on cow's ears to identify them. And we just literally hammer them into the reef with a masonry nail. So makes it easy to find them when you have to come back. And you can see there's the little coral, the tile with a little bit of coral exposed there. So you can see why there's a lot of work, a lot of investment and effort for not a lot of return on investment, at least not for a long time anyway. It's still worthwhile doing, but the amount of coral that you're looking at there is probably less than the surface area of my thumbnail. But if you do this a lot, and it's still definitely worthwhile. So then the last thing we need to do is, remember, we took those parent colonies out of the water. Now they have to be returned. And so the next thing we do is we take those and we go right back to the spot where they were obtained. We try to put them back in exactly the same location where they came from in the first place. And that's what's going on here. This is Danny's got one right here. There's another one here. And they're getting ready to glue these down using the same splash compound material that we used for the tiles. We'll put those back. So that's the process. Looks like I'm doing okay on time. Some of the things we want to do in the future. While we were there, we agreed that collectively we could all work on a research project that something that a lot of folks are curious about is how important are internal cues, meaning the circadian rhythm, to coral reproduction versus the external cues, things like the length of day, the phases of the moon, the water temperature, all of those things. So what we've agreed to do is all the various aquariums that were part of this, we're all going to get together and we're going to set up some tanks and we're going to replicate the conditions that are down in Guam, right down to the exact same lunar cycle and photo period and water temperature. All of that information is easily available. And we'll by using some computer programmable lighting systems and so forth, we can replicate that pretty easily. We'll get some corals from Guam, we'll put them in there, and we'll wait and see if they spawn at the same time as the ones out in the water in Guam. We expect that they will. Then what we do next is we're going to mess with those parameters. We're going to shift them by maybe a couple of weeks off or something like that, just to see if the corals will resynchronize themselves or not. If they do, that'll tell us that there is at least some internal cues that they're receiving, what's known as a circadian rhythm. And these are things that are of interest to coral biologists. So it's a way that we can all contribute. And if all of us are doing it at various different aquariums, it increases the statistical possibility that we're getting good results. So it's one way we can kind of help, even if we're not actually down there. We would like, perhaps at some point, to develop an exhibit here, talking about, CCOR and our project down there. It's something we think that the guests would find very, very interesting and intriguing. And then we want to continue to do the same kind of work in the field, in Guam or wherever else the opportunity might present itself in the future. So that pretty much concludes things. I would be remiss if I didn't thank Paul Servaggio from the Pittsburgh Zoo and Aquarium. He's the individual I told you that was responsible for most of the photos in here. He was also my roommate, and he put up with my snoring. So he's a pretty good guy. I want to thank the aquarium for allowing us to go, and the Marine Conservation Research Institute, and Tom Turney, the chair, for providing some of the funds that allows us to participate in this project. Of course, Sandy and Danny, who were on the trip with me. And that's pretty much it. So anybody has any questions?